Hi, this is Andrew.
And this is Amy, and this week AADL talks to Jesse Thorne and Jordan Morris of the podcast Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Eli and I talked to Jesse and Jordan about how an episode of Jordan, Jesse, Go gets put together, how the media landscape is changing to make shows like theirs possible, and building a community of people who you've never met. Let's go. We'll do, like, an intro and all that kind of jazz later.
Great.
So, you know, we'll just jump in.
Just start.
I don't know if you guys know how, like, how radio and things like that work. But we can actually edit this together.
Hold on.
Later.
Yeah. Who are you? What's going on?
I suppose we might as well start with some kind of background on both of you and how you got interested in doing comedy and just talking for a living.
Jordan and I went to college together. I was Jordan's RA. I was 1 year ahead of Jordan in college on the performing arts hall at UC Santa Cruz.
Yeah, right. Very, very prestigious organization. Real dipshits.
Yeah. There were a lot of real dopes on that.
No,
hall.
Yeah. Also, I do retain some people from that hall as some of my best friends in the world. But everyone else was a real dipshit.
Yeah, there is this guy who was always coming and knocking on my door just at crazy hours of the night, asking for extra large condoms.
Sure.
But anyway,
that seems pretty cool. I think that guy was clearly getting his fuck on with a giant dick.
Is that a requirement when you're an RA? Is you need to have all sizes of condoms available in your
Yeah, and you have to know the dick size of all the gentlemen on your. I went to Performing Arts High School in San Francisco, where I was a theater focus. So I did theater 4 or 5 hours a day through all of high school, but I was never a great actor, and never really aspired to, like, I enjoyed doing theater, but I never really aspired to be an actor because partly because I knew that I wasn't that great at it. Like I never had the, I've never had the ability to, sort of access my emotional depths. I've built my whole life around avoiding my emotional depths essentially. Also because I just can't imagine anything worse than a life where my whole living inability to buy food is based on auditioning for things, because auditioning for things is really brutal for me, especially because I don't like being judged. I sort of decided to start a radio show when I got to college, largely because it seemed manageable. After I visited the radio station and, like, saw where a radio show came from, I was like, oh, well, that's not very complicated. And I knew that, like, in order to do, like, something involving cameras, you would need cameramen and sound people and a best boy, whatever that is, a gaffer probably.
Yeah. I think perhaps now in the world of guys who want to get into comedy, video making is probably the first thing that people think of. But I think when we start, you know, just we were in that little pocket before.
Yeah, we were like 2 years before someone could afford to buy a video camera that was in college and we were 23 or 24 when YouTube became a thing, and when you could get your videos hosted for free. So, you know, video was just sort of like a little bit beyond our ability to pay. And so essentially, like, I went and volunteered at the radio station to get so that I could apply for a show. I applied for a show, and I basically just asked the people that I liked, that I thought were the most talented that I knew, to do it with me. And that was my friend Gene and Jordan. And Jordan was essentially this guy on my hall who I remember being annoyed with him because I was like, oh, man, he's going to be the funny one on the hall. But then
I did bring a lot of VHS tapes of Mystery Science Theater 3000 to college with me. So I think you saw that.
Plus, you were always wearing clown shoes and putting fake vomit on things.
Sure. Real cut up.
Essentially got into radio not out of some great vision for radio being the ultimate apotheosis of what I wanted to do, kind of like you hear public radio people often saying, but more just because it was a thing that could be done. And Jordan and I also did improv through college. We did sketch after college. Jordan's still doing sketch today at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater.
I would say me similarly. I was just kind of a kid who was just kind of obsessed with The Simpsons and Mystery Science Theater 3000. And when I got into high school, I was I did the plays. I didn't go to a arts high school specifically, but I was I did like Our Town and The Secret Garden and stuff like that. But then kind of.
He played the garden and the town, respectively. Mm-hmm. The lead parts.
I was very fat in high school. So I played.
When he sat around the theater, really sat around the theater.
So I played settings. Yeah. Not characters, but settings.
Which was good because then the set department could just get something printed up at the t-shirt shop.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. I think my second year of high school, they introduced Comedy Sports with a Z, which is kind of this organization that teaches improv to high school students. It's kind of silly. It's like that kind of game-based improv where you get a bunch of movie quotes and then the audience makes their favorite barnyard noise and you put a bag on your head and a kind of improv nerds today would find it kind of silly, but I mean it just blew my mind. And then I kind of decided that that's kind of the thing that I wanted to do. And yeah, like Jesse, no interest in learning any kind of technical skill to make a video or something, and also B, realizing that I'm not a compelling actor and hating my own emotions and only wanting to think about jokes and nothing else.
I remember being in theater school. I mean, the theater school that I went to was pretty serious. Like, a lot of my classmates are now professional actors of stage and screen. And I remember being in theater school and just being so annoyed that I couldn't just make jokes. Like, that was like so frustrating to me that it was considered to be like a lesser form of theater if I only wanted to do comic monologues. And I took this physical theater class, and the teacher of the physical theater class was a professional clown who had been a clown in the Pickle Family Circus, which was this sort of they sort of invented the idea of like the alternative circus or whatever in San Francisco. And he had been, he'd done all kinds of things since then. He'd done a lot of like Commedia dell'arte and stuff. But I remember being in that class and just being so annoyed that we had to do all this theatery stuff and he couldn't just show us a funny thing to do. Because like occasionally we would like accidentally learn a funny thing, like we'd learn how to do a particular take or something, like some time-honored like joke thing. And it would be so great. I'd be like, look at this. I'm better than everybody in the class at this. Like, this is so great. I can do this in any context, and people will think it's funny. Like, this is wonderful. And then we would have to go back to acting like a certain kind of animal.
Well, I have kind of a follow-up on that. I think that one of the things that's interesting about the YouTube generation at this point is that the YouTube as platform for getting stuff out there has lowered across the culture people's expectations of what video is, to the point where I think in the late 90s and early aughts, there was if you were going to do a video project, you had to do it right, otherwise people wouldn't take it seriously.
Yeah.
And I think that do you guys think that there's a lower bar for making a global product because of the exposure of YouTube, just in terms of production quality?
I might argue that just seeing what the entertainment industry is interested in, I think now it has kind of come back around. I think when YouTube was first a thing, something being kind of lo-fi was an asset, to the point where even I think people were making things more lo-fi than they could, because that's what entertainment executives and whomever thought a YouTube video should be. It's like you should have a lot of room noise and it should be not scripted. But I think now we're in kind of a different place. I mean, very recently, where I think that even your home production in your garage, people want to be almost movie quality just because you can. Like, it should be in HD, and you should have mics and stuff. And that's very recently. So I think that, you know, I do think people now, or at least people who are looking at things for, you know, people who are looking at web video for, can this be something other than a web video, now would like it to be almost, you know, broadcast quality, because I think you can do that now. So
I think the can do that now is a big deal. In that, I, like, for example, I do a web series called Put This On about men's style, and Adam Lissagor, who directs it, he's since we started doing the series, has become a sort of important figure in the world of web video, especially making commercial web videos. And we shoot, I would argue that Put This On looks better than, I would say it's one, if it were on television, it would be
it
one of the...
looks better than Say Yes to the Dress.
Yeah, it would be one of the best looking nonfiction television programs. And Adam shoots our show on a still camera. You know, he just presses the button really fast. No. The camera
it's
that...
It's less a web video, more a magic lantern show.
Yeah. We should explain that.
It's actually just a horse running.
Yeah.
Everyone there's gets scared
a,
when the train,
train
drives
coming
the
towards
screen,
the screen.
Sure.
Yeah. No, he shoots it on a Canon 7D, which is essentially designed as a still camera, but it's a still camera that happens to also be able to shoot video. And I don't know what they cost, but I mean, it's like it's less than a couple thousand dollars. And and that technology is like freely available. And if you have some skill, you do have to have skill. But if you have some skill, you can make something that looks better than the things that are on TV. In fact, there are lots of TV shows that are hamstrung by, you know, having old people working on them or union rules, et cetera, that they can't do this. And only now is television realizing, like, oh, maybe we should just be using these still cameras. For example, I just interviewed Sarah Vowell the other day, and she was going to be on the Carson Daly show. And there was a guy there shooting B-roll for the Carson Daly show, and he was shooting it on a Canon 7D. And he said, you know, our show isn't even in HD. Like, he's shooting HD on this still camera. He said, our show is still in standard definition because in the studio they're required by the union rules to use these cameras or whatever. And but when they do field stuff, they realized it was better to just buy seven Canon 7Ds so that every person who might do a field piece just has their own camera than buy one $30,000 camera that's a little bit worse that everyone would have to like check out. My feeling is that, yeah, that while there was, while when it was novel to be able to make a web video, there was a value to that. At this point, because it's so much less complicated to make something that looks good, looking good becomes much more important. And you see a lot of the most popular web videos, looking good is an important part of them. I mean, if you think of like, you know, the video of like the dad and his son who like sent a balloon into the stratosphere and shot video with an iPhone attached to it or whatever it was. The key appeal of that is the aesthetics of it. It's not just, I think a novel thing happens in this video appeal has softened. Like, it's definitely still there, but, you know, people have seen a lot of novel things now. And so now there is some interest in something that is good. Now, I will say, I would like to see more web video producers use actual microphones.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't understand why
room noise is still a big problem in the world of web video.
Like, I don't understand why are there are these videos that are like so high production value in every other way. Just because an iPhone can shoot pretty good looking video in natural light. But they don't bother to use a microphone to get the audio, and so you can automatically tell that it's total amateur hour and it's very difficult and unpleasant to watch. So that's my recommendation for anybody out there who's thinking about making their own video. Get a camera that can record audio and use a microphone other than the one that's built into the camera.
If you guys had come up 20 years earlier or 15 years earlier, do you feel like you could have
anything approaching the careers that you have now, not as podcasters, but even as someone who makes a radio show out of his house, as someone who is a host on a deep cable network, like, would what you do have even been possible, I don't know, even 10 years ago, would you have been able to do this?
Yeah, here's the thing that I've had to come to realize about my career is that
you're not above porno.
I am not above porno. Gay, kidnapped, I'll do it all. I mean, chicks, certainly. Yeah, I mean, I'll fuck some chicks.
That's an easy decision.
No, but other stuff too.
Yeah.
Also other stuff. Yeah,
tentacle stuff.
So here's when I was graduating college and thinking of moving to LA, here was the story I had heard over and over again about how one makes it in the comedy business. You move to LA, you become a PA, it's a production assistant. You know, you fetch coffee, you copy scripts. Eventually, you become a writer's assistant because you've shown hustle and niceness and stuff. And, you know, then you work with the writers for a year, and then you get to write a script, and boom, you're a writer. You get an agent and stuff like that. But between the time I moved out to LA and the time when I was getting jobs, that changed so drastically mainly just because there's so much less scripted programming on these days. And when you look at the writing staffs of scripted programming, it is all veteran TV writers. It is guys who wrote on Friends and guys who wrote, you know, on season 3 of The Simpsons, because there is not a lot of scripted programming out there, and they want to make sure that it is staffed by people who know what the fuck they're doing.
There's like literally like 30% as many of those kind of shows as there was 15 years ago.
So that model that I had always had in my head, that model that I was dreaming about through college and thought I had figured out so well, was now not anything. And then we did get into that world where people who made YouTube videos were getting TV shows, and this wasn't like, you know, staff writers didn't sign a deal anymore, and there wasn't first look deals for comedians. Like, it was dudes who made YouTube videos, and it was really confusing for me because I just thought I had this thing figured out, and then...
Then you started being attracted to guys.
Then yes, and being kidnapped on film. But yes, that fucking sucks. But also... You know, there are all these jobs to be had in the world of web video, like the Funnier Dies of the world have writing staffs. And there are a lot of boutique cable networks like Fuel TV, the one I work on, that while they don't pay a lot or aren't watched by anyone, is a place where someone with limited experience can get employed and get a start and get a reel. So... it definitely took some figuring out for me. It's like, so yes, absolutely, it's crummy for aspiring comedy writers that there's not that set path into it anymore. But also, there's just other ways to do it. And it is through the world of internet and deep cable and just finding a way that you can get paid to be funny. You certainly won't get those TV writer residual checks or health insurance in my case. But there is still a way in, and it is through these kind of smaller means. So,
and yeah. I think Jordan and I have interesting sort of parallel careers, because Jordan's career is his television work. Like, that's where he makes his living, is working on Fuel and doing other television-related things that he does for other networks and so on, and, you know, the occasional commercial or whatever. So that's sort of like Jordan's career, whereas but at the same time, I think Jordan, correct me if I'm wrong in saying this, but in a funny way, like, Jordan Jesse Go is still sort of at the center of your career, kind of artistically, creatively.
Sure. Definitely. Whereas I don't make my living from the podcast. Jesse does pay me a bit to appear on it. It's a very generous sum, and it's nice, and it definitely helps. But yeah, as far as like where my rent comes from, it's from TV. But the weird part is that more if you look at the Nielsen ratings, more people listen to our podcast than watch the TV show that I appear regularly on.
And also, I mean, it's like the podcast promotes you,
sure,
in a way that you, where you have control over it, and it's your product that is your voice, in a way that would have been difficult for someone who was working primarily as a comedic actor to achieve 15 years ago. And you know, there's a certain extent to which you can achieve that by working at the Second City or at the Upright Citizens Brigade in the comedy world, or writing a one man show if you're an actor or actress. Which is why Los Angeles is so choked with one-person shows. But the defining characteristic of show business used to be that someone else had to pick you, that you had to make your living through auditioning for things. And so the fact that you can create your identity and assert it, even if that's not at the center of your income, is a really important thing in terms of getting work and just knowing who you are and developing your skill. You know, I think that's part of why, so like even in like the Apatow crowd, you know, all of those people are distinguished by the fact that they are creating their own projects rather than just being cast in things. So you know, Jason Segel wrote or co-wrote Forgetting Sarah Marshall because he knew that if he just pitched it as a movie, they would cast someone else. And if he was just auditioning for it, they would cast someone else. They'd cast someone more bankable or whatever. But if he's the creator of it and the star, he can get cast in it. It's his project all around. And I think that comes from this new idea that, like, oh, you can just make something. And for me, that actually is my career. Like, I host a television show on IFC, and my relationship in terms of career with the television show I host on IFC is more like Jordan's with Jordan Jesse Go. Like, it's nice to get paid to host a television show, and it's cool to go in and do it. It's a fun project to work on, and the people are great and so on. But it's not where I make my living. So for me, essentially what happened is I graduated from college with the idea that maybe I would work in public radio, and I applied for just a buttload of jobs and didn't get any of them, including lots of jobs in commercial radio. And because I was already with my now wife at the time, I didn't want to just move to Poughkeepsie and then just – essentially the radio industry is just a story of these sad men, mostly men, who just travel from small town to small town because they get fired every 18 months. And that sounded like the worst thing in history to me. And so did, frankly, stand-up, where it's sort of like the same thing. You're just always in some place looking at the same mall in a new town and you don't know anyone. And either you just drink after the show with the waiters and waitresses, or you know, if you're clean and sober, you just go to three movies a day. And it really makes people really miserable. So I didn't want that either. And essentially, I was just lucky. Like, I just kind of hung on to The Sound of Young America, my college radio show, just long enough that, right around like a year and a half, 2 years after I graduated from college, and when I was still driving to Santa Cruz from San Francisco, you know, an hour and a half drive to do my college radio show, which was pretty pathetic, I sort of was able to, I was like, I had these twin sort of triumphs of getting on a real radio station and also podcasting being invented, and thus me having direct access to the audience rather than indirect through a radio station. And, you know, at the time, there were still very few people interested in me as an entertainer or whatever. And so the fact that I could directly access the audience meant a lot. And it didn't mean money until literally another 5 years after that. But at this point, like, I make a healthy middle-class income through media, and the media that I make the money from, even though I'm on a few dozen public radio stations, I barely make any money from that. I make even less than I make for hosting the television show, but my income comes from being able to access the audience directly, which is a new thing. And I don't know I think I'm talented enough, and you know, I think Jordan is talented enough. I think we're both talented enough that we would have been able to do something in the entertainment industry. I feel like I'm 29 right now. If I'm lucky, I might be hosting like a local public affairs show in like a third tier market right now. So like I might be in, you know, if I was really lucky, I might be in like a second, like a Memphis or something like that. And if it wasn't, then I would be in, you know, Butte, Montana or whatever. And like nothing against those places or that job, but what I get to do now is just way cooler than that. Like that's a nice job. That's a great job to host that show. But for my interests, like the fact that I get to make dick jokes with Jordan as an important part of my job, or like, you know, help adjudicate stupid personal disputes with John Hodgman on the Judge John Hodgman podcast, like those are so much cooler to me than that other scenario.
Well, and I think it's really that direct access is so disruptive to the media business. And it seems like that's still in the process of shaking out, and it's going to take a long time yet. So I guess what's so striking about your guys' audience is how much they love you. Not that they shouldn't, but you know that it's, I mean,
maybe they shouldn't.
Well, no, but yeah. You don't see that.
We've done a lot of bad things you don't know about.
But you don't see that with NPR.
Skeletons in our closet.
Yeah. You know, and I think that the, what's most, the biggest difference between what you guys are doing and the NPR establishment is the fun drive. I mean, I am blown away by the Max Fun Drive and the way that you guys approach reaching out to your audience, what's in it for them, and how, you know, people feel personally involved, both through the segments that you do on your show and through just what they get for their money, which is a very far cry from the experience of donating to your NPR affiliate during their twice yearly fun drive. And I guess my question is, does the NPR business end, or the whole kind of public radio machine, are they looking at the way that you guys are doing business and saying, that's the future, we better get in on this? Or are they saying, that upstart, what the hell does he think he's doing?
It's both. I mean, it's an interesting thing. So essentially the way that I make my living is I run this website called MaximumFun.org, and that website is the home of about half a dozen podcasts. And of those podcasts, one is The Sound of Young America, my public radio show. That was the original. And then we added Jordan, Jesse, Go about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And then we've sort of added things along the way. And now there are a couple of podcasts that are run completely by other people. And my role is essentially to kind of help them monetize their podcast and build their audience and so on. But it's sort of this community of like-minded programs. And, you know, and also a blog and a message board and stuff like that. And because I was in public radio already when I started podcasting, the public radio model for fundraising made sense to me. And I felt like it would probably make sense to the audience. And that's donation-based. So even though MaximumFun.org is not actually a nonprofit, so the donations are not actually, you know, tax deductible and so forth. And in fact, it is a profitable enterprise. You know, it is supported by voluntary donations almost exclusively. I mean, there's some other income, but almost all of it is voluntary donations. And essentially every choice that I made was based around the fact that I was just one guy. So like, for example, we raise money on a subscription basis. So people donate a certain number of dollars per month. And most public radio still raises money on a one-time donation basis. And the advantage of one-time donation is that theoretically you can move people up the ladder. That if people have a lot of money and they give the idea is the circle of giving is that they start by getting involved. They start by being aware. Then they – I'm getting too much into fundraising stuff. But they start by being aware and then they become engaged and then they become a participant and then they become a donor and then they become a major donor. And that's sort of how nonprofits have raised their money since time immemorial or whatever. And I knew that because I was too busy making programming to do the kind of like client service that's involved in getting, you know, in cultivating major donors, which is what they call it, that I'd better do something where I don't have to convince everyone over and over to donate. So I was like, well, I'll have it be a donation that comes monthly. So, you know, it's a small amount of money, $5 or $10 a month that people are pretty comfortable with. It goes automatically. So they don't have to constantly say affirmatively, I want to give, I want to give, I want to give, because the real difficulty in raising money that way is not so much how much people miss the money. They don't miss the money. They're happy to give the money because they like supporting things and it's not that much money for them. The bigger issue is almost always just that it's annoying to donate. So I've been doing that for 5 years, and that's something that public radio has literally just started doing in the last 18 months. And I don't know if that, you know, here in Ann Arbor they do that on the station, but sustaining donorship is, you know, I know at Chicago Public Radio, where my editor works, this is something that they started working on about a year and a half ago. And that's always been the basis for what I do, because I knew that I needed a consistent donor base and I needed to be able to not spend my time raising money, but rather spend my time making content. And I think that that is also supported by the fact that in podcasting, it's every time, every show that you listen to is a show that you affirmatively chose to listen to. And so our relationship with our audience is a very intimate one, because they have – it's not just something that happened to come into them, into their ears, until they were sort of used to it the way that, you know, you can expect with, you know, a sitcom or something like that. You know, like According to Jim is not a very good show, but people like it because the sitcom has that kind of built-in familiarity, and just after a while they just got used to watching it.
Or even like, I mean, All Things Considered. How many people listen to All Things Considered because they listened to it in the car when they were a kid?
Right, exactly.
And I think it seems like this crop that is our audience of, you know, kind of youngish, educated, web-savvy people, it seems like that idea of sticking up for the thing that you love is something that is part of their media consumption. Like, All My Children got canceled recently. When we came, and you know, there was no,
and our fans were
pissed. But you know, there was, you know, because the audience for All My Children is old ladies. Like, there was no Save All My Children campaign. But you know, when Chuck was threatened from going off the air, this is a show on NBC, which I imagine kind of there's some overlap with us. That the type of person that listens to our show also was the type of person that was Chuck's target audience. You know, there was Save Chuck Twitter campaigns, and because Subway was Chuck's sponsor, you know, everybody who loved Chuck would go to Subway every day just so the show could stay on the air. And I think while people weren't...
Our target audience also happens to love Subway.
Sure.
So that's also convenient.
And while people weren't sending Chuck monthly donations to keep, you know, Zachary Levi's salary paid, that idea of we realize that there is a lot of media... And we also realize that, you know, not everything is American Idol, and some things need you to support them if you want them to continue. So, and I think that is an idea that is very much, you know, something that our demographic gets. And I think that that idea probably will be more prevalent in media these days or moving forward.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I kind of see two things driving that push. One of them is that... I think young people who are our age and younger are like, I'm 29, Jordan's 28, right?
Yeah.
And we were the first generation where Napster came out when I was a freshman in college. So I am of the generation that had both high-speed internet and access to free media, albeit stolen media. So I think everyone who is our age and below has almost naturally had access to all the media they want for free if they're willing to put in the effort. And so I think the thing that comes – there are two things that come out of that. One is I think there are a lot of people who perceive that as being a sort of sense of entitlement, which is to say people feel like they don't have to pay for things or whatever. And I think that is an issue, although I don't think it's the pure issue that some people see it when they're looking at it through an old media prism, because I think the other side of that is that those same people feel so strongly about what they choose because they have the choice of everything in the world, because they are exposed to literally everything if they want. You know, they can just go on allmusic.com and find out about any kind of music in a way that someone who's 10 or 15 years older than me who had to go, like, talk to a clerk at a record store couldn't. They really care about the things that they chose because it was a very informed decision. And they are often, again, not always, I think that entitlement is in sometimes a real thing, but they are often willing to voluntarily, even though they don't have to, even though we're not a nonprofit even, give us money because they see they take seriously that idea that they should support things that they care about. And then the other side of it is I think that there's this there's the only precedent is geek culture, where, you know, I was reading an article in The New Yorker about the guy who wrote Game of Thrones, the Game of Thrones series, and or I don't think that's the name. Something About Fire and Ice is the name of the series. But one of the books is called, the television show, which is what I care about, is called Game of Thrones. And he was talking about how, like, every woman he's ever been involved with, he met at a fan con. And he was talking about how much he cared about fan con culture of the 1970s, where geeks would go to a place and all get together and appreciate the things they appreciated. Now, I think that there are people now who can meet women in other places who are starting to appreciate the best parts of that, which are these groups of people who really care about things. And the internet really changes one's ability to access those groups of people. And so I think a big part of what we're doing is essentially curating a group of people, that we have this group of people who are fans of ours, but they're more fans of each other's and fans of the kind of people that like our show. Because our show is about, you know, it's about a couple of different things, basically. You know, it's about funniness, it's about being intelligent, and it's about not being uncomfortable with being vulgar or whatever. Like being, but also, in addition to those three things, not being a dick. And so few things have those four qualities. As you know, most things I think that are funny and intelligent are often about being a dick, or, you know, many things that are funny are about being dumb, many things that are intelligent are about being not funny, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is this kind of curated group of people who care about these things. So while they are fans of me and Jordan, or they're fans of The Sound of Young America, or fans of Judge John Hodgman, what they're fans of the most is each other. And they like the idea of being just like the guy who wrote Game of Thrones liked the idea of being in a group of people that, you know, he could get naked with and they wouldn't judge him for being fat, and, you know, that he could talk about Tolkien or whatever. Our fans like the idea of being in a community of people that have those qualities that are at the core of what we do. And even if whether or not we are like the perfect exemplars of that, you know, like, I don't think we're the funniest people in the world. You know, I think, you know, as long as Paul F. Tompkins and Patton Oswalt and sure. Maria Bamford
continue
are alive
to live.
Yeah, we won't be the funniest people
but
in the world.
But we're seeing to that.
Yeah. Now that we've got a little more money, I think contract killings are closer to our...
Sure.
But, like, it's more about building that community, and then people want to support that community. I mean, if you think of, like, for example, to use a non-geek example, if you think of the world of Harley Davidsons, like, do people really care about Harley Davidson because of something special about the motorcycles themselves? I mean, they're great motorcycles. You know, they may be the best motorcycles of the kind of motorcycle they are. I'm sure that's up for debate. What people like about Harley Davidson is the community. And, you know, Harley Davidson figured out that, like, what they're in the community business, not in the motorcycle business. And so, you know, they make a lot of money selling motorcycles. They make a lot of money selling motorcycle T-shirts, and they make a lot of money, you know, supporting motorcycle festivals. And plenty of other people make money with motorcycle festivals and, you know, things where 50-year-old women take their tops off and so on. that's what I presume happens at Harley Davidson festivals.
And it's really interesting. I mean, we, you know, something that we've been doing a lot is having meetups, and we had one after our show that we had here at the library last night. And yeah, and it was a place where I feel like I had a conversation about Jackson Pollock with someone, and then turned around and had a equally stimulating conversation about the continuity of the Fast and Furious movies with another group of people, and it is, and that is a very specific group of people that want to talk about both of those things. But I think that's why the meetups are such a, you know, success across the board, and not, you know, just a bunch of weird dorks milling about and, you know, pouncing on the one female dork who happens to be there. It's that it is. It's a place where, like, you kind of, you know what kinds of things you can talk about, and you don't have to feel like you're going to have to explain them to anybody.
And I think another thing that's happening from the business perspective is that, like, you know, we're here in Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor is, you know, I guess probably counts as like a third tier media market.
In our dreams.
Yeah.
We don't have a television station.
Pretty small place. And even, you know, regionally, not a huge population to access, you know, maybe a million people within extended driving distance. And we drew, you know, 100-ish people, which typically 100-ish people is not – if you can draw 100-ish people in a place, that's not enough to make enough money to go to do something. But then of those 100-ish people, I would say 30 or 40 came to the meetup. And if you can imagine the, like, of the 50,000 people that go to a U2 concert, if 20,000 of those people wanted to hang out with each other afterwards, no, that would be completely absurd. And essentially, what you realize real quick is that if people are willing to give you $5 or $10 a month, which isn't that much money, you know, those 30 people, just those 30 that came to the meetup, if those people are willing to give us $10 a month, that's $300 a month. And there's a lot of Ann Arbors in the English speaking world. You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden you add it up and you're like, oh, yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Like, I can actually afford to, like, make a good living from this. And it's because and it's new that you can do that without – it's largely new that you can do that without building a mass product, without that just being your objective, especially as a performer, as a creative person. You know, like, I definitely see – like, I'm definitely the business end of the operation, but my business work is only – because I know that I have to do business stuff in order to support myself doing the creative stuff that I want to do. And, you know, I'm not someone who, like, looks for holes in the marketplace. I've been using this lately, a reverse entrepreneur. An entrepreneur looks for unfilled needs in the marketplace. I look for stuff that I want to do and then try and figure out how to make a living out of it. But the idea that a performer is the one that's making the money. I mean, it's like the, you know, it's like when people are complaining about, like, how athletes make too much money. Like, yeah, well, would you rather have the owners make that money, right? And so I think it's really cool that the people who are making the stuff can be, if they want to be, the ones that are making the money as well. And that you don't need to appeal to, you know, an audience of 1 million is a failed television program, a failed network television program. And an audience of 1 million is a handsome living for 6 or 10 people who are working on a niche product.
Does knowing that there are all those people out there who are interested in what you're doing and who like what you're doing free you up and make you feel not nervous to bring people in, particularly people that you might be nervous about interviewing to begin with, people like Dick Cavett, bring them in and still be yourself and be able to joke around with them? And I mean,
you're referring specifically to when I opened my interview with
interviewing Jim Cotta.
Yes,
that's what I'm talking about.
So Dick Cavett, who people probably know as the legendary talk show host of the 1970s, you know, former stand-up comic, a writer for the New York Times these days, was on my show, and there are a few, if you want to be an interviewer like the kind of interviewer that I am, there are a few models, and it basically just comes down to Dick Cavett. Like, that's pretty much it. Like, I think Dick Cavett was brilliant. I mean, I think he probably has. He's not, like, the greatest interviewer perfect of all time. But in terms of what I want to do, he's it. Like, he's the center of that universe. So I was pretty nervous to interview Dick Cavett because I really admire him. But I knew that he was a gymnastics champion. And in his book, he wrote a little bit about how he's always annoyed that people introduce him by talking about his Emmy nominations and his Emmys, and they never mention the fact that he was state gymnastics champion of Nebraska. And so I made sure to mention that he was state gymnastics champion of Nebraska, because I think that's really cool. Just like I think it's cool that, like, Woody Allen was a high school basketball star. And then I was like, hey, have you ever seen this movie, Gymkata? Because Gymkata is this movie that is a hybrid of martial arts and gymnastics, hosted by a former American gymnastics champion.
It came out in the kind of mid-80s, around the time of, like, Bloodsport and American Ninja. And
yeah,
so
this
it's
is
one of those types of movies.
It was the last film of the director of Enter the Dragon before he went completely insane. Like, this guy just lived off of Enter the Dragon for 10 years, and then it was just – he just – lost, you know, he overdosed or whatever. But it's just totally insane. And I was just like, you know what? All evidence would suggest that Dick Cavett's a good guy. I think I would like to ask him if he's ever seen Gymkhana, because if he hasn't, I bet he would think it was pretty funny. And he did. He thought it was great. And it was definitely a gamble. It's possible that he would have thought I was completely insane. But I knew some people. Frankly, what led me down that path was we have a friend, Dave Hill, who is sometimes a contributor to This American Life and has a great show called The Dave Hill Podcast Explosion and does a great stage show in New York called The Dave Hill Explosion. And he's like a musician, kind of raconteur. He's like a comedian who doesn't have an act, is sort of what he's just charm. He just explodes with charm and enthusiasm for things. And I knew that he had interviewed Dick Cavett a bunch of times. Like, he just looked Dick Cavett up in the phone book, literally, called his house and asked him to come be on his show on stage in New York. And Dick Cavett said yes, because Dave Hill is such a charming and sweet guy. And I knew that, like, if Dick Cavett liked Dave Hill, he would probably be okay with me asking him about Gymkhana. But, yeah, like, what was cool about it was, you know, when we were editing the interview, Nick, my editor, and I were talking about, should we leave this weird Gymkhana part in where I'm just giggling about how funny the Village of the Crazies is. So in Gymkhana, there's a scene called the Village of the Crazies where he's in this village that is sometimes called the Village of the Crazies. Sometimes it has a different name because there's a lot of continuity issues in Gymkhana. And he's, like, running from all these, like, sort of zombie-like madmen. And he, like, runs into the town square, and he, like, looks over his left shoulder, looks over his right shoulder. He's completely surrounded by these murderous madmen. And then he's like, oh, but what's this in the town square? A pommel horse. I knew that also that Dick Cavett did the pommel horse. So me giggling about that was something that if we were just doing a straight public radio show only for public radio, we probably would have just cut that out because it's weird. And that's the thing that public radio program directors complain to me about when they listen to the show. They say, why do you have these weird digressions? And to me, in a funny way, that's what the show is about. So I think we may have ended up cutting that out for the radio. I don't remember if we did or not. I think we at least cut it way down for the radio. But we left it in on the podcast because we thought it was pretty funny. Like, we thought it was a kind of a funny thing. And Dick Cavett was, like, charmed by it. And he opened up a lot after that, I think, because he was like, oh, this is just some nice guy that likes a weird movie about a pommel horse.
But it seems like you guys are also setting yourselves up for some terrifying experiences. Jordan, you seem to have some, I mean, you must have people who don't get the joke, who you're sitting there with and you are joking around and they don't get the joke. What do you do?
It's Jordan's job.
Yeah, it's my job on Fuel TV includes a part where I go to, like, a press junket for a movie, which is one of those things where the stars sit in a hotel room and the journalists, you know, kind of rotate in 4 minutes at a time. And I will go in with kind of a weird bit or a costume. I'm trying to think of what's a good example.
I remember you did a bit at the premiere of, this is going back a little bit, but sure. At the premiere of Nacho Libre, where you were dressed up like an old-timey blackjack dealer, and the premise was that you were trying to talk the various stars of the film into introducing you to Jack Black so you could play blackjack with Jack Black.
Sure, yes. yes, I've also done intelligent things.
Yes.
No, maybe not. Maybe that's about par for the course, now that I think about it. Yeah, so, you know, it's this kind of funny,
it's like an interview that you can present in the 3 minutes that it becomes in a television program out of the 4 minutes that you get with each group of people from the movie.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, so it's kind of supposed to be this fun take on entertainment coverage where it's not, you know, it's not just who was fun to work with and tell us about where you shot the movie and stuff like that. So it's, you know, and yes, and it's definitely not something that we set, you know, no one sets the star up, which is kind of a neat little convenience that I just get to walk in my baby outfit or a lot of, I was going to try and think of another one, but a lot of babies, a lot of man children outfits.
Kiss makeup
is one. And just kind of present them with this comic premise and see if they what they do with it.
See if they yes and it in improv parlance.
Yeah, and usually I have a pretty, despite that being kind of weird and disruptive and maybe even something that could be seen as disrespectful, I have a pretty good success rate and have not, and you know, even if people don't like it, which, and I try not to make it about slams. I try not to make it Perez Hilton-y where I'm making fun of them, but I'm kind of maybe presenting myself as a ridiculous character that they can one up. And I think for the most part people seem to enjoy it, and if not, they fake it so they don't look like idiots or, you know, assholes. I have had a handful of problems, and I think we talked about this with Paul Scheer on the podcast. He had a friend who kind of did a similar thing, and they had this formula for knowing who will play along, and I think it's pretty accurate. The A-list celebrities like to play along because they're secure in the fact that they're famous and, you know, don't feel that
they can't be embarrassed by a goofball in a costume.
Right. The C-list celebrities love it because they're just happy that a camera is being pointed at them, so they're happy to do whatevs. Definitely C-list. It also very much applies to reality show stars. If you just want them to do something, they'll just do it. But it's the B-list celebrities that you have to watch out for because it's the people who feel like they are on a precipice and kind of have something to lose, to, you know, to where they feel like one goofy web video painting them in a negative light could destroy the career that they're on the precipice of. And I think that's been very accurate. All the people who have had a problem with it have been pretty firmly in the B list.
And I feel like the part of the deal from watching it is that this is such, and from having been invited to these junkets, is that there's no actual journalism. The whole setup is specifically to prevent you from being able to do any actual journalism. It's to prevent you from finding a storyline. It's so that they can control what the media story about this film is.
Sure.
And it's miserable for the people who are in it. Like, the people who have to answer the same question over and over and over, it's horrible. It's just truly a miserable, horrible experience. And so I think a lot of people...
And also because the people who do these junkets, typically entertainment reporters, are the worst people.
Yeah.
They're like, think about the bad qualities of an actor, of an LA actor. Think of all the bad qualities you associate with that kind of person. Now remove the fact that they care about creativity.
Yeah.
Which is something you could tolerate about an LA actor. It's, at least they care about creativity.
At least they're making art. They're trying to. They aspire to art.
These people do not, for the most part. I do have a few friends in the biz, and they're wonderful. But, for the most part. So, you know, yes, I do think for the actors.
There are a lot of times they're just glad for the respite from answering the same question over and over. At least something novel is happening.
Yeah, and all, you know, and all the people that I've done this with, who you can say are all the big celebrities, have all seemed to really enjoy it.
You also get the impression that I feel like people are glad that someone is just acknowledging what a ridiculous thing this whole setup is.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just sort of like it's like a little breather for a lot. Like, a lot of people just kind of sit there and sort of smile and nod at you and like,
yeah,
this guy's putting on the show this time.
Yeah, and I've even actually had a publicist kind of admit that to me once. They said, well, we know Fuel TV doesn't get great ratings, but it's actually kind of a strategy for us to put you in the middle of the day so that a kind of tired celebrity might get a second wind because something happened that they kind of enjoyed. So it's, and also nice of them to assume that they would enjoy my thing. So that's from a person who kind of really got that bit. Anyway.
I was wondering if we could talk about the way a JJ Go episode is put together. This doesn't happen as much now.
Not really.
Well, I know. In the early days of the show, there was a lot of this, like, Jesse, you would say, okay, we've been talking for 20 minutes about this, and that's not what this segment is supposed to be about, which was always very funny because the segments are supposed to be about something. Like, so I'm wondering if you could talk about the planned structure of the show versus the fact that it's really just a show of people sitting around and bullshitting, you know?
So, essentially, the format of Jordan Jesse Go grew out of what The Sound of Young America was before we when we were doing the show together. So when Jordan graduated from college, he moved to LA to do that path that he described, to become a PA and then become a writer's assistant and then hopefully become a writer on The Simpsons or whatever. And so I moved The Sound of Young America to being all interview at that point because I couldn't bear the idea of trying to carry a radio show by myself. And when I moved to LA myself, Jordan and I decided, why don't we do all of the parts except for the interviews of the old Sound of Young America as a show? So since we made The Sound of Young America just the interviews, why don't we do all the like little comedy bits and stuff like that we did before? And it took a while for us, I think, to get comfortable enough to talking on microphone about just miscellany that we could do it entertain. It took us a while to gain the skill that's required to do that entertainingly without having something that we'd written or whatever to go on. And essentially at this point, the structure of the show is we almost always have a guest just because, especially, you know, Jordan's life is so dominated by flying to a weird place to do a film junket, and my life is so dominated by just sitting in my office working every day that, like, not that much happens to us. So, like, Jordan just sometimes something interesting will happen to Jordan because he's in Hawaii for the premiere of Surf's Up. But basically, we can't rely on, like, events in our lives. It's sort of like how Howard Stern only talks about things that have happened on the Howard Stern show now because that's all he does. That's sort of like for us. And essentially what we do is, so we have a guest who we can always talk to about their experiences. And it's nice to have a wild card in the room, especially when there are people who are, you know, we have access now. When I say access, I mean sexual access to
anal
all
access.
Yeah,
access to the anuses.
Backdoor
of LA's finest comedians.
But we know all these just really brilliant people, you know. So like the fact that we could just get Paul Scheer to come by, who's, you know, not very famous, but is a little bit famous and about as brilliant as it gets, is like so amazing to us that it feels like it would be foolish for us not to invite Paul Scheer over. And so essentially what we do is we just kind of come in and I have a little list on my iPad of like interesting things that have happened to me that I try and, on my iPhone, I try and remember to type something in. Like if I see a weird billboard that I want to talk about, I try and remember to write it down. In fact, like right now, for example, if I look at that list, I have, written on here, Snoop's Nate Tat. That's so that I want to talk about the fact that Snoop Dogg got a tattoo of Nate Dogg, which is not that weird because Nate Dogg died and they were close friends. But that underneath it said, all dogs go to heaven, which is just really embarrassing thing to have on your body permanently.
Below that it says, the land before time. Yeah. So they're unrelated. It's like, well, I'm going to get some titles of Don Bluth movies. But then also a tattoo of my friend.
And then cat leash. I bought some chairs on Craigslist, and the guy had this really weird cat leash system. Boner pills. That was something that I think we talked about last week, which is that I don't understand why fake boner pills still exist when there are now real boner pills available. USA 3000 airline. That's that I saw an airplane, and the airline was called USA 3000, and it seemed like an airline that someone bought at Walmart from the bottom shelf. And then the idea of invited guests, which I thought that sometime it would be fun to, like a nightclub promoter, claim invited guests on Jordan Jesse Go, which just means people that you invited that aren't going to come, but you put them on the flyer, like Kim Kardashian or whatever. So, like, I try and keep a little list of things, and then Jordan kind of does the same thing. And so before the show, we'll just check in real quick. I'll just ask Jordan if there's anything he wants to talk about, and I'll put it down on my list. And then I'll ask the guest, you know, sometimes, especially if it's a repeat guest, they'll have some thing that has happened to them that they want to talk about. Like, you know, Jen Kirkman came in and she was like, oh, I'd love to talk about the weird meth heads that live outside my window. And so we're like, okay, great.
Yeah.
And basically, and then usually on the show, often on the show, we'll try and have one actual bit. Maybe, you know, we'll do. We have got some recurring bits and stuff that we try and get work one of them into a show if we can. Although we've done less of that lately, I think just because we've grown facile with just talking about nothing. And then essentially, I just try and lead the conversation however I can, you know, as the host of the show, try and make it coherent and punchy. And And, you know, it is pretty – it's meandering, but there's so many podcasts out there that are aimlessly meandering. I feel like our show has a focused meandering in that I think there are a lot of podcasts where no one is actually hosting the show. And I do take pride in the fact that I do host Jordan, Jesse, Go. Like, I do make sure that things are a thing. And, you know, Jordan always, when he's talking about something – you know, he is a great storyteller, and it's a real thing. Like, it's never just aimlessness. And, you know, we also have breaks built in so that if I'm spacing out and can't think of anything, I can always just go to a break.
Sure.
But, yeah, like, we used to do a lot more bits, but that was more because we were scared that we wouldn't be interesting if we didn't have bits. And it's great that we have those bits still because it demonstrates that we're capable of
producing,
making, yeah, thinking of something. Sure. And when we do a live show, it's almost all bits because, you know, I feel like when you go see something, you want to see a thing that's like a thing. You don't just want to see people gabbing. And I think, you know, there are a few. I feel like I've seen Jimmy Pardo and his show Never Not Funny live, and Jimmy is such a brilliant gabber that he can pull that off. But I think he's the only person in the world who can genuinely do that. I guess people think Kevin Smith can do that. But like Kevin Smith thinks that, for example. but he's got a lot of support. A lot of people buy tickets for that.
And we also try and also have an element in every show where we deal with the audience. We have an answering machine that people can call in and, you know, a pretty accessible.
Wouldn't it be funny if it was an actual answering machine, like with a mini cassette?
Oh yeah, and we had to.
Or like if we just had an answering service, like a lady that answered our line,
right, and gave us our messages.
Yeah.
So I think that maybe kind of is something just formally that sets us apart from the bazillions of other guys gabbing podcasts out there is that we always try and have a part, and that, you know, kind of fits in with our philosophy about having the meetups and that everybody kind of being part of this little group is that. You know, we take questions and give listeners assignments and always make sure to make that a part of the show.
And that is something that I actually, when we were thinking of Jordan, Jesse, Go, that's something I stole from Zay Frank, who's an acquaintance of mine. And he created the show called The Show that was the first great success, one of the two, along with Rocket Boom probably, one of the first great successes of web video, like serial web video. And a big part of what he was doing was, and he's much better at it than I am or we are, frankly, but a big part of what he was doing was just creating weird things for his audience to do together. And having a shared project is a really great way to build community. You know, it's just like how, you know, sending people on a scavenger hunt and all of a sudden the three people on the same scavenger hunt team are best friends. Having an assignment for everyone just makes everyone feel a sense of togetherness and community. And that I always saw that as being the one of the best parts of talk radio, call-in talk radio specifically, that sense of community. You know, the fact that Rush Limbaugh's callers call in and they, you know, say, I'm a total ditto head, you know, which means we're all of one mind, you know what I mean? And there was this guy, I used to listen to sports talk radio when I was a kid, and there was this guy who called into the Gary Radnich show. Gary Radnich is this local Bay Area broadcaster who at one point, he was doing a morning show on radio and then the 6 and 11 o'clock news on television. So he would do the 11 o'clock news. It would go off. He would go to, you know, that ends at midnight. He was a sports reporter, so he was the last thing on. He'd go home, go to bed at 1, and then get up at 3 to do the morning show. And he was just sort of like this Bay Area, like in the Bay Area, like he's like so beloved. And there was this guy that used to call into a show called Johnny the Gout Man. And, like, you know, and when Johnny the Gout Man would call in, everyone would love it. And he's like our friend Tom Sharpling, who hosts The Best Show on WFMU, which is another very popular comedy podcast. You know, he's so wonderful with building a community out of his callers. And because we weren't doing the show live, we knew we couldn't do live calls. But I wanted to have that spirit in Jordan, Jesse, Go, which is why. And so that's how I was like, well, Zay doesn't do his show live. He's building that spirit in a time asynchronous fashion, or in a funny way, like at this point, especially with Twitter and stuff, it can be like a continuous thing. I mean, if you look at the way our colleagues at Maximum Fun, my brother and me do it, it's like a continuous stream of community and working together and people tagging tweets, MBMBAM. And, you know, I mean, they have a five-digit audience, but of those five digits, you know, there's hundreds of tweets every week about their show because they've done such a great job of building that kind of sense of it's like a constant call-in show that only happens to go on the air once a week.
One of the things that strikes me about the audience base of all your shows and our website and working here at the library, we can really see the edges of internet culture and how far the internet culture does.
Hobos masturbating, right?
Well, sort of. They are the transition zone between internet culture. But you know, it's always because all of us in the IT department, you know, we are thoroughly inside internet culture. It's not like there's something on Boing Boing that everyone hasn't already seen. One of the things that's interesting is the limits of that, in that, you know, only occasionally does something break out to the real world or to the old media, the broadcast world, if you will. Well, and, you know, Keyboard Cat perhaps being the best example, where it was this thing much beloved by the web. All of a sudden it's on CNN. And why did that happen? And so I guess my question is that, do you think that the internet culture model of every outlet having its own 10,000 or 20,000 or 50,000 fans is going to be the dominant media format for this century? Is the blockbuster doomed? Or is that notion of the super huge mass market, intensely marketed thing going to continue to be able to survive with its overhead compared to the types of things that's happening on the net?
My guess is, and I say, you know, like, I've got a lot of my life invested in the success of the small thing, and I feel very bullish about that. And I have basically just chosen that I don't want to make my life trying to create a mass thing because it seems like a real frickin' hassle to me. I don't like the idea of, like, trying to anticipate what people who I don't like would like. So I've just sort of written that off as in terms of my, like, if it accidentally happens, you know, if I make a Put This On TV show and it's, and you know, it becomes Queer Eye for the Straight Guy rather than, you know, target women on Current, you know, which is something that is more likely, then that's great. But, it's not my goal.
It's now Modern Lady.
No.
Target women.
No.
It's now Modern Lady.
Oh, it's now Modern Lady?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It switched. Sorry.
That's because our pal Aaron.
Our parent, yeah, just for Aaron the sake of Aaron Gibson, who is not listening to this, who is now the host of that. They changed the
name. She's very funny.
Yes.
Sarah Haskins, who hosted the other thing, she's also very funny.
Absolutely.
Aaron Gibson's hilarious, though.
Sure.
They're both very funny. These are talented people. We work with them. We have a lot of talent. We, as Jimmy Pardo would say, we wish all of the actors and actresses in Hollywood all the best. but my guess is, and again, this is for something that I have not thrown my life's lot in, is that what we will see is a continuation of what we have seen to this point, which is that huge things made for a mass audience will continue to exist because they do serve a valuable role in our culture. There is a, you know, there are great ways to monetize them across, you know, Toy Story is a huge success, not just because a lot of people go see the movie, but there's a lot of ways to make money off of Toy Story.
And Pixar G-rated equals G-money.
Exactly. And you know, and Toy Story is tremendous. Toy Story is so wonderful. And so, you know, there's good and bad versions of that. I mean, obviously Transformers 2 is horrible, but Toy Story 3 is wonderful. So, you know, it's possible to do a good job or a bad job of that thing. And so my guess is that will continue. And it will continue to be something that huge corporations pour billions of dollars. You know, I'm sure that Toy Story 3, they spent $1 billion on it. I'm sure that was the outlay was about $1 billion. Like, it cost a couple hundred million dollars to make it, a couple hundred million dollars to market it, a couple hundred million dollars for overhead and miscellany and so on. So $1 billion. But they probably made a couple $1 billion off of it. And I think that will continue to exist. My guess is that the sort of things that are in between will fall away. Now, the good news is that sucks because then you lose the – I mean, I think it's fair. It's disappointing that you lose the – you know, independent movies of the early 1990s, or you lose the adult Hollywood dramas of the 1970s, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and even it's this kind of disheartening to think that maybe these are the last days that like a Parks and Rec can exist on NBC, like a critically beloved but kind of low-rated show. I mean, I think that, you know, whereas everyone wants to see those things on TV, you know, people who make TV want to see those kinds of things, that the reality of it just being cheaper to put on a cooking competition is probably going to take over.
I think the good news, though, is that because of the plummeting costs of production for other things besides talent, you know, I think that, to use the example of Put This On, which is nonfiction and is thus a little bit lower overhead, I mean, that is literally me and Adam. It's two people. And sometimes when we need a boom microphone, we have to get somebody to hold the boom. But otherwise, we use lavalier microphones, and it's literally just the two of us working on it. And I think that because that is possible now, there are better opportunities for smaller groups of people to create Parks and Recs. So Parks and Recs would still require the efforts of, you know, 30 people. But it wouldn't require the efforts of 125 or 150 people. And that is where my hope is that the technology and stuff like that and, you know, efficiencies and increases in skill and, you know, increases in ability to leverage skill will improve. Now, whether that means that we'll get – it's entirely possible that means that we'll have more – 6-episode runs of things like that than 23, which is what we get now. But it's still, I don't despair. I feel like in my lifetime, the entertainment available to me, especially like from things other than books, from things that require complicated production, you know, books is just a guy writing, but things that require a bunch of people working together and a lot of technology has become so much better. Like, I can look back on when I was a kid and, like, The Simpsons was a really amazing show and Seinfeld was a really amazing show in 1994. You know what I mean? That's it.
Yeah, no, it is definitely, like, it is definitely, you know, as people who work in the biz, we kind of hear the panic a lot and we read all the stories about how there's no money for anything other than reality cooking competitions. I think it is kind of, if we do step back and look, it's like, hey, you know, Archer exists and everything on Adult Swim exists. So
there are less jobs for miscellaneous people.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's a bummer and, you know, like in L.A., you feel that. Like you feel like you can understand that, you know, the difference between a production that employs 1,000 people and a production that employs 30 people, like that's just a lot of people who don't have jobs, you know, like caterers, and that's a bummer.
Yeah, but sure. And definitely why when I moved to LA, you know, there still is a show called Ass Cat at the Upright Citizens Brigade. And it's, you know, just kind of the night of improv in LA, and all of the best people, you know, are in it, and they have, you know, prestigious guest stars sit in. And I think, you know, when I moved to LA, everyone involved with Ass Cat had some sort of deal, you know, whether it be they were developing a web series or they had some sort of TBS first look or something like that. And definitely, unfortunately, those, you know, you do see the world's funniest people.
There's less
around,
kind
not
of
working.
Miscellaneous money.
For sure. And
but, you know, that pushes people to make things for themselves. And that's how my whole career came about, is that I couldn't get any miscellaneous money. So, you know, I don't think it's all bad.
If you'd like to learn more about Jordan, Jesse, Go or any of the Maximum Fun podcasts, go to MaximumFun.org.
Music for this episode was Sun Behind Me by Brad Sen, which you can find on the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnetune.
AADL Talks to Jesse Thorne and Jordan Morris has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library. Pushing